Welcome to Masters of the Stage. This SDC Foundation program illuminates the creative processes, secret mottos, and personal and professional experiences that guide today's luminary directors and choreographers as they forge artistic careers in a profession that has no handbook. These intimate and dynamic conversations between today's most successful artists offer audiences rare insights into the challenging and ever-changing world of theater making. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
I'm David Roberts. I am the executive director of the Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation, and this is our one-on-one conversation series. I want to extend a special thank you to Tina Fallon and Dramatists Guild of America, our streaming partners for today's conversation. So thank you. And our conversation today is entitled, The More Things Change, Shifting the Narrative on Who Gets to Lead. I am pleased to welcome today's guests. Liesl Tommy is a Tony-nominated and Obie and Lortel award-winning director whose recent Broadway production of Danai Gurira's Eclipse, starring Lupita Nyong'o, garnered 6 Tony nominations. Liesl made history as the first woman of color ever to be nominated for the Tony Award for Best Director of a Play. She also recently made her TV directorial debut on Ava DuVernay's show, Queen Sugar, on Oprah's network.
Yeah. Oh,
so good. It's my current binge watching. And we are joined by Stephanie Ibarra. Stephanie is an artistic producer, currently putting her skills to work as the director of special artistic projects at the Public Theater, where she leads the mobile unit and the public forum programs. Additionally, Stephanie serves as the Producers Lab liaison for WP Theater and as curator and casting director for Two River Theater's Crossing Borders Festival of Latinx Plays. She has served as producing director of Playwrights Realm and producing artistic director for the Cherry Lane Theater's Mentor Project. Welcome, Liesl. Welcome. So Liesl, I'm going to kick it off. So here at the Foundation, we assert that directors are leaders in every room they walk into. And this it can be as true of a rehearsal hall as it is of a boardroom. And I recently saw an interview where you shared that rather than starting your own theater company, you chose to put yourself in front of artistic directors and insist that they hire you. Why was this important positioning?
Well, when I first started out, I did this thing where, because I was applying to a lot of fellowships, I did this thing where I wrote a manifesto of what I believed theater is and what I believed my place in the theater was. And I had a 10-page version of it, a 5-page version of it, a 1-page version of it, and a paragraph.
Yes.
Because then I could articulate it at any point in any way with as much or as little time as I had. And also it was cathartic for me because I was working in a restaurant at the time. I was not, you know, I was in that horrible place of just hunger. And it helped me to, you know, feel like I knew what my journey would be. And as I would, you know, apply for these fellowships and talk about it, people all just said, oh my God, you're, you know, you really have a clear vision of what you want to do. You should start your own theater company. You should start your own theater company. And I realized that the majority of people who were telling me that were white people in positions of leadership at theaters. Very excited about what I had to say, very excited about the vision I had for the field, but I should start my own theater company. And the path to starting your own theater company was more brokenness, was, you know, like, you know, I mean, my journey was very hard. I did not have a financial cushion. I had to hustle it for a long, long time. And I just thought, if I start my own theater company, there literally is no hope for supporting myself in a meaningful way for a very long time. And also, why, if they see the value of what I'm talking about, are they not hiring me, these theaters? So I made a very pragmatic decision to put my face in front of them relentlessly and insist that they hire me. You know, I have this saying, which is take space to make space. And it started then because I realized if what I did for them was successful, that meant that they would then entrust more and more people who looked like me, with these jobs.
That's great. It's powerful. And do you feel that that's a form of leadership? I mean, not leading an institution in this sort of formal way, but, sort of being the vanguard for others in your
yeah,
wake.
I mean, I think so. I guess for me, because of the way I was raised and where I was raised, you know, in South Africa during the struggle, my parents were both, you know, real activists and advocates for civil society, right? Mm-hmm. That was never, to take it on, I guess, was never not an option. I mean, it was it was just what had to happen. So if I was going to be in this field, I was going to have to deal with all of the issues in the field. And as a person of color, as a woman, you cannot hide, you know, bury your head in the sand, because it affects you directly. It affects your life. It affects your ability to pay rent. And that's, you know, that's all it is. It's just any other field, having advanced degrees, having the experience that I have, you know, I wouldn't be at the time have been at the bottom of the employment barrel scraping along. You know, I had colleagues that I started out with, whose trajectories were just so different because they were white or because they were men. Mm. You know, so it was very clear what there was no gray area in terms of the bias inside of the system. I used to say we live in a racist and a sexist society, and it is magical thinking to think that it doesn't infect our industry just because it's the arts. Mm. Mm.
And do you have to fight that battle in every sort of artistic office that you go into?
Yes and no. I mean, one of the great joys of you know, building my career was finding artistic directors who became true collaborators, became true colleagues. You know, and even then, you have to push them. You have to shake them outside of their, because usually, you know, it's white men, you know, outside of their comfort zone. But fortunately, when you're able to build those relationships, it's not as overwhelming as it seems in the beginning. You can start, you know, poking at them. Mm.
So this is a great place to bring Stephanie in. Yes. You know, we're sort of all
poking at them.
you know, we're all familiar, or three of us are familiar with that LORT model. So it's a large nonprofit institutional theater. Usually has some sort of dual leadership model, a generative artist, usually a director, maybe it's a writer, maybe it's a choreographer, and a managing partner. Is that part of the issue, or what are you seeing in the field now in terms of...
Barriers to entry?
Well, sure, barriers to entry or change. I mean, I'm also discovering that a lot of artists are now multi-hyphenates. They're either working in different media, or they're... Not saying that I'm a single sort of path artist. I'm a writer and a director. I'm a director and a designer. And it feels like that might be happening on the producing side too.
Yeah, one of my great struggles and great joys in being an artistic producer is having to articulate what even am I and what kind of artist am I. So I've gotten to a place where I now say I am a facilitative artist, or some variation thereof. And I do think that one of the challenges that we're facing as a field, when we think about who gets to step into these institutions and lead them, is we have a very, very narrow definition of what an artist leader is at the top. As you said yourself, like, the model is baked into a dual sort of a bifurcation of the producing models. You have an art side and a business side. It's debatable whether or not that's healthy, but fine. And on the art side, traditionally, like since the beginning of the regional theater movement, that space has been occupied by a stage director. And I think as our field, and that's not bad, that's not wrong, but as our field grows and evolves, I do think part of the key to creating an inclusive ecology is recognizing and understanding that there are different genres of artists, and that that sort of one discipline does not equal your ability to lead an artistic institution. There are designers, choreographers, dramaturgs, playwrights, artistic producers, and directors, all of whom, actors, all of whom are totally capable of helming the artistic side of an institution. And the sooner that we understand that and can foster that, then I think the greater chance we have at diversifying in all ways who is at the top of our organizations.
So to some of the things that Liesl was just speaking to in terms of that glass ceiling or the gatekeepers, let's call them, largely white, largely male, in the prominent theaters. How have you faced that coming up inside of organizations? Or as a producer, you know, trying to make space for generative artists?
Well, we were just talking about this right before we came in. You know, Liesl's sort of stake in the ground early in her career is like, I will not do this on my own. I'm going to be in your house and in your face and using your resources to make my art. This is a very similar impulse to what I had as a younger artistic producer, which is just, you know, I refused to spend my own money or raise money, start my own theater company. Mm-hmm. I was doggedly pursuing jobs inside of big institutions. And of course there are ceilings. There are ceilings. It's not just about, it's like left, right, mm-hmm. up top, behind. You know, all of it. All of it.
Oh.
Yeah. Even side ceiling. Yeah, yeah. It's everywhere. And I think that, but to me, I think that has created a really robust muscle at throwing, I think throwing my whole body, like my whole heart, soul, body up against every aspect of that ceiling. And sometimes it cracks, sometimes it breaks, and sometimes I just get bruised. But I've developed a pretty thick skin. I'm mixing my metaphors now. But I think that is what is required, is every single one of us from wherever we sit inside of an institution or outside of an institution or inside temporarily, is to just be, you know, throwing things.
One of the things that we also talked about earlier was as a young director, one of the things that I found when I was working at theaters was that the artistic directors often wanted to pair me with more experienced designers, which I totally, understood. It's that everybody's just trying to mitigate risk at all times, right? Like if you're a young playwright, we want to match you with a older director or more experienced director, etc. There's just, it's fear. but what I found was that these more experienced designers were always all white men. So I think it was maybe my second or third show where I said to the artistic director, as they were coming at me with lists of designers, I was, you're not going to surround me with all white men, are you? Mm. And there was just that moment of horror and discomfort. Well,
did they not notice?
No, they didn't. That's the other part. I mean, that there's a colorblindness works in so many magical ways, right? but they didn't, and there was like that moment of shock. And I was like, I remember thinking to myself, you're going to have to get used to this look. You are going to have to get used to making people uncomfortable. And some people are going to reward you for it, and some people are going to blacklist you from their theaters, and that has happened. But the point is again, it's back to that take space to make space, right? Like it's just, there's just no way that you can step into the opportunities and not bring people with you. For me, at least, it's impossible.
What were the next steps of those conversations? Like when you had that first, you know, that first confrontation after their sort of shock and surprise at,
yeah, it was
having an all-white team.
It's a constant negotiation. So then, you know, then you go, well, then suddenly there's all the explanation is, well, we need local designers. It's a budget thing. So you're telling me there's no people of color in this city that we can hire, or women, you know? And then, so then you just start to, it becomes a money thing. So, okay, so if I'm going to work with these two local designers, then I need to bring these two in from New York with me. And it's not about the fact that they're from New York. It's about the fact that we are talking about diversity. And that was just something that I always advocated for. It was just a non-negotiable for me.
That's great.
But what you're describing, just to like punctuate it very clearly, is not just an advocacy. There is a strategy operating there too, and a value that is actually core.
That's correct.
To who you are as a human and an artist. And it's maddening, but super important to have that kind of that skill, to be doing that calculus all the time. Okay, who do I have on my team? All right, if this is going to fall, if I think the wind is blowing this way on a particular artist or a particular role or a particular designer, then I need to make sure that I hold this space just in case, right? Mm-hmm. And that it sucks because it's exhausting, but it is absolutely what is required in order to kick the door open and like get as many people in there as you can.
Yeah.
So that's part of, it sounds like it's part of both of your curatorial processes. So when critics or resistors try to say, well, experience, or well, I don't have a relationship with person X, mm-hmm. person Y, how do you go about curating your teams? And what, you know, is it made up strictly of art, or is it, you know,
for me, it is, I am a extremely demanding director, and I consider myself to be very rigorous, and there's just no way that I could work with a designer who was not the top of their game, because I would drive them insane, and then I would have to fire them. So
never fun. Never fun.
So there's, you know, the thing that is so shocking is that I've never ever had to compromise on quality when I've hired women or people of color. It's never ever happened. The people I've wanted to fire were usually these older white men, to be honest, who just were not keeping up with the cultural conversation that I was interested in having. So, you know, this idea that we're somehow, you know, compromising on quality, it's just such a lie. It's so boring. And, you know, you just have to be relentless, you know. And the other thing is 10-page manifesto, 5-page, 1-page paragraph. I usually have an answer for everything. Like, I've already, you know, I've done all of the research. I know all of the statistics. Like, you know, there's just, you have to create you have to become a walking, you know, lobster trap. Like, you know, like you get them in there and you surround them with the thinking and the argument. And there is no argument on the, you know, to combat it, to get themselves out of being a part of the solution.
And Stephanie, when they say, well, we have diversity. Look, our team has 4 out of the 10 people on the team are women.
I do not, I'll just say, I am a female identified, I'm a woman, and yet I don't love the gender as a sort of measurement tool, because it actually inherently does not contemplate us. Like, it is so easy for women of color to get left out of that equation. So for me, I have laser focus on race. That is the foot I lead with 99.9 times, because I think it is the mother of all isms. Mm-hmm. It is the key to actually, if we could undo that thing, then the whole system crumbles. And I think that, so, you know, that's a thing. So I don't look at an all white team or an all white situation with white women and think that is diversity. It may be a form of gender diversity, but it is not satisfying to me. And just to bring a different kind of phrase or vocabulary into the room, that word, the D word, diversity, I am done with it.
Why?
Because it leaves too much wiggle room. Too much ambiguity, too much like, oh, look, but they're so socioeconomically diverse, gender with diverse, you know, oh, somebody doesn't have an MFA, diverse. Those are all things, those are all conversations that I've had.
And they're true, right? That can
sure.
be true.
And for me, that is not what I'm going for. So the vocabulary that I've started to use with friends like, you know, you, David, is anti-racism. I would like to deploy anti-racist practices here. I would like to hold anti-racism as an animating value in the curation of this season, this team, this et cetera, et cetera. And once you lay that on the ground, like once you put that phrase on the table, then it opens up and makes more valid, I think, all of the arguments and the statistics that Liesl is referencing. So then it's not just a value proposition about an artist's like capacity to culturally understand the whatever, whatever, whatever. We're talking about people's livelihoods, and we're talking about perpetuating a pay gap, and we're talking about keeping our foot on the neck of artists of color, so on and so forth. So that we then are looking outside over there across the aisle where racism is happening, and all of a sudden, it is so close to home. And who doesn't want to be a part of fighting that? Like, who doesn't, who can say no to that, you know? So it again, it's just like walking my lobster trap. I love it. The number of resources that you have to have at your disposal, and the different kinds of languages and sort of tactics you have to be able to deploy in order to make space and hold it, keep it there.
So in your abstract creative team, because you curate as well when you're curating a season.
I do a little of that.
Before you do this question, what you said is so profound, and I just want to throw in one other thing, which is that just because you have diversity on your team, on your artistic team, or on your... The question is, do those people have a voice?
And what do you mean by that?
So if you have four artistic women in your, you know, artistic leadership office, does that mean that everyone is free to speak, or are they merely window dressing? Mm-hmm. Are you creating space for people to be honest with you about their point of view, about their politics, about what they think about the structure of your theater, about the way that decisions are made? That's the work. It's actually valuing people's voices and creating space for them to articulate them.
How do you know when that's happening in a theater that you are either a resident at or a
guest
artist at?
It's very clear. It's very, very clear. It's so clear. You know, it's like, I don't know.
Without naming names, like how does it sort of play itself out in a room?
You go into a meeting of our artistic leadership to talk about notes for the production or to talk about designers, and if the artistic director is a man and the associate is a woman, or the dramaturg is a woman, and that woman never speaks that entire meeting, that tells you what that dynamic is. Or, which has also happened, after that meeting is over, that woman then asks for another meeting where she gets her turn to talk. Mm-hmm. That to me is insane, because my time is valuable, so I'd have to do two meetings for the same project about the same things, but it's because, you know, that man sitting at the top of that theater needed all of the time to get, you know, this is the stuff that I'm talking about. It's really the rigor that people have to employ to do this work. It's unrelenting, because it's just the tiny little tip of the iceberg in terms of progress.
When we put this talk out, we said, how will the theater industry move beyond just planning for diversity, equity, and inclusion towards implementation of these values? And you said that it's constant. It's constant work. Let's talk about how these institutions are formed, made up. Who are the people that make up those institutions? Who are the decision makers? What you're dealing with boards of directors been, for example?
Well, this is very interesting, because, you know, I've worked all over the country, and, you know, just almost every city there's a Lort A, B, or C, or D theater. I've worked at that theater at some stage in my career over the last 10 years. And I've always, pretty much always, find myself at some stage in front of a board talking about the production or talking about my work, or, you know, there's a certain amount of interaction that you have to do. It keeps boards inspired. It keeps boards connected to the work. And I also am aware sometimes when, you know, you look like me, that it keeps boards feeling good about themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but it's all part of the job when you work in the not-for-profit sphere. And I've also been fortunate enough to be on boards. I was for about 4 or 5 years on the board of Sundance. They have a program where they bring in every 4 years artists. They call them artist trustees, and we don't pay the many thousands of dollars that board members pay annually, but they believe that we are providing an important resource, and that is why they create a space for us at the table. And then there are other places, like the American Theater Wing, where I'm on the advisory committee. And, you know, the conversation about diversity on boards is never ending. I think pretty much every board that cares is constantly talking about it. Some people do things about it and some people don't do things about it. But that, you know, that conversation is essential. Boards have to be, have to continue to diversify, what their, that community looks like. And the same with, the marriage of the executive director, the financial component and the artistic component. That's another, at theaters, that's another area that just is not diverse enough.
And Stephanie, you've had to do some fundraising, and I mean, you've had to do some of the similar things with boards. What is each of your experiences in being a creative, interacting with this board, with these boards? What is it? What do they know and what do they not know about the art, about what it takes to make the art or what it takes to run an institution?
I mean, I'll just dive in. You know, I feel like boards are amazing people. I don't, you know, they don't have to do it. They don't have to take time out. Usually these people are so busy. They are, you know, they're extremely high functioning individuals with a lot going on. Mm-hmm. So I am always amazed that they will give up their time and their money. Mm-hmm. And then they will also just get on the phone and call their friends up and ask them for money as well. It's an amazing thing that boards do. At the same time, as we're moving into this realm of filling these artistic leader positions, I feel like the thing, and I had a great conversation with the board at Berkeley Rep about this, you know, very thing. What is an artistic director? What is an effective artistic director? What should we be looking for? What should we be thinking about? You know, one of the things that boards can never understand is what it is to be a visiting artist at your theater, right? Is the structure a structure that's welcoming to everybody? Many a time I've been the one that got hired first when a theater was trying to like open up the conversation. And I recently got hired at a big regional theater that was, you know, known for being pretty white bread. And the new artistic director said, look, we're looking to do this. And I finally, after years of being that person that was the first hire when they were looking to do this, I said, listen, does your staff, are they on board? Because I really don't want to go again into a theater that has been lily white for years and then be the one that they think is like some sort of diversity hire and is not qualified to be there. Because I've actually encountered that with the production manager, with the TD, with the education department, with, you know, it's just never ending. And they're, you know, they're like looking at you with hostility because they think that you're some kind of symbol of something. And it's so exhausting. It's hard enough to put up a huge show, you know, at a regional theater and then also encounter resistance. And it's, is it me that they're resistant to, or is it this new idea that they're resistant to? Because it makes them feel wrong, like the work that they've been doing for all these years is wrong. You know, so there's so many layers of understanding that people have to have when, you know, when they are starting to enact change. And it starts at the top, you know, and there's, you just wish that there was that this conversation was constantly happening, not just with people like us, you know? And so what I wish going forward is that these theater companies, these boards, managing directors were really rigorous in setting up these complicated conversations because it's literally every nook and cranny of their building. They have to be having the conversation.
Yeah, I will see you, the managing executive directors and boards, and raise you also the current sitting artistic directors. And I think that the conversations that I've had with boards even some very recent, around, you know, a like healthy understanding of what it is to lead an institution, and yet they don't know what they don't know. And if particularly boards who have been with one artistic director for decades and more, I think they're sort of encountering or experiencing artistic leadership through one very narrow prism. And anybody who is leading an institution knows that there are myriad ways artistic leadership can manifest itself in an institution. And so to the extent that current sitting artistic directors out there in the country are invested at all in the future of this field, then they must start socializing the idea and an example, and offering up examples of, this is what it looks like over there. This is what it could look like. Or let's talk to some people to imagine what doesn't currently exist. Mm-hmm. All of these things are valid. There is not just one way to do this job. And that is, I am afraid, given the sort of length of the tenure of artistic directors in the country, I think that we've gotten into a little bit of a very narrow lane, narrow field of vision with regards to what artistic leadership could look like.
I think that goes back to what Liesl was saying earlier about, you know, mitigating risk.
Yeah.
And how that is sort of paired with fear. You know, this is the model we know. So this is the model we want to replicate.
And there's the other thing of just also setting people up for success, right? Yeah. Like, right. This is something that I talk about all the time when I teach, when I talk to artistic directors, is you want to bring people in, but you don't, it's the same as the anecdote I just told you about being on the forefront of like a changed building. You want to bring people in, you want to bring in, you know, people who are thinking outside of the box, but you haven't created a structure, an infrastructure for them to thrive. You make them, you put all the onus on that one person to come in and be a supernova.
Exceptional.
Yeah, there's that. But it's actually your job to make sure that the entire building is ready for the future.
So before I open up to Q&A, both here in the room and online, we all have our circles of professional friends that we talk about these things with, but social media has certainly changed the landscape. So I've noticed both of you online. You've extolled the virtues of calling people out online. But why is that important positioning? How does that move the needle forward for women? How does that move the needle forward for people of color? Multi-gender identified folks? How does it move the needle forward for the rest of us?
I think it just raises awareness, personally. I think that Liesl's very salient point about the conversations must be happening in every nook and cranny of every building, of every constellation of artists, of every et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, you know, all people are sort of they come to this work at a different place in their life, in their journey, in their sort of awareness, sophistication, knowledge, what have you. I look on my social media feed, I have a couple of folks in my feed on both Twitter and Facebook that I'm like, wow, I thought I knew and I did not even know. And I look to them to shine a light into my blind spots and challenge my thinking. And I think that that is a positive way to think about pointing at something and saying, y'all, this is that thing that you say you hate. That thing, white supremacy, that we think happens over there, here it is, right here. This is how it manifested itself, and nobody meant to. That's just like our country. And so, you know, amplifying those moments, I think, helps to raise awareness and helps to create conversation for better and for worse. And also helps to hold institutions accountable for their choices.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing for me is that there is the woman of color invisibility factor, right? Mm-hmm. So in terms of the media. So I could be out here for 10 years doing all of the work, you know, getting all of the awards, all of that stuff. And then you could have a young white male director who does two shows. And he gets a profile in the New York Times, right? It's where it's just there is not a level playing field in terms of who gets recognized, who gets their voice.